KHOI's Heart of Iowa is proud to bring you a conversation with Neil Harl, Charles F. Curtis Distinguished Professor in Agriculture, Iowa State University, in recognition of a career during which he became an internationally recognized expert in farm finance, taxation, estate planning, business planning, and agricultural law. As a professor emeritus, he continues to publish and give seminars on these topics. This impressive professional vita does not include another aspect of Professor Harl's character, that of critic and watchdog for the interests of Iowa State University, as described in his book, Arrogance and Power, The Saga of WOI-TV. In his role as president of Iowans for WOI-TV, Professor Harl organized an energetic group that worked for years to prevent the forced sale of WOI-TV. Although the sale took place in 1994 in spite of their heroic efforts, the spirit of this resistance is what we honor today. Our host for this discussion is Emeritus Professor of Journalism, Tom Beal, a participant in this struggle, together with Professor Harl.
We're talking about the sale of WOI-TV, which was put on the air by Iowa State University and operated by Iowa State University until forces aligned to force the sale of the station, despite what I would say a Herculean effort on the part of a bipartisan group of people, both faculty members, retired people, people who lived in and around Ames and elsewhere, in fact, because we did a call out once around the state and got a lot of support from people who said that station should remain a vital part of Iowa State University. But despite our best efforts, the station was sold. And sadly, it was sold at a time when broadcast stations, the market was at its low ebb, so that this incredible asset was sold practically, it was practically given away.
It was about $12 million.
Every good book should have at least one villain. This one had three. Marvin Pomerantz, Terry Branstad, and Martin Jisk. And that's what people were worried about. Here's the top guy in the state, and here's the guy who really calls the shots with respect to him. And then you've got Jiske, who's nothing but a lapdog.
And he was the president of the university at the time, for those who don't remember. And Marvin Pomerantz was president of the Board of Regents.
He had just been elected and made president the same day. You see, Parks had been collared by him, Branstad, in November of 1985 to sell the station. And Parks said, "You're going to have to fight me on that one." Now, Bob became one of our staunchest supporters.
Bob Parks was a longtime president of the university. And he was a beloved president because he expanded the liberal arts program dramatically and appreciated the importance of having a broad university, not a narrowly focused university.
And Pomerantz was quoted later saying, "Parks made the wrong turn. He should never have expanded, because what he was trying to do was to limit this place to an institute, agriculture, engineering, and science." And I can tell you firsthand, because I was on the strategic planning committee, about 32 of us, that was supposed to basically come on board and be very supportive of this. And a bunch of us dug our heels in. And that's why it went nowhere, and that's why Eaton resigned.
Yes, Dr. Eaton was president for only a short time, and the story was widely told on campus, or rumored, let's say, that he just didn't do what the regents wanted done, which would have hurt the university, and to his credit, he didn't do it. And he was not convinced that was the way to go. Well, this story, we're referring to a wonderful book that you wrote, and I remember at the time you wrote it because I was one of the members of the group trying to save the station. Here is this unique, virtually unique, only one other university I know of, had a commercial television station where students could get experience and where the university's message could be distributed to a wide audience. And here was WOI, an old station, really, in the terms of the stations going on the air in the Midwest. And here it was vulnerable for sale because certain people thought it didn't fit the university's mission.
Actually, what happened was Pomerantz was voicing a view heard at the University of Iowa. I was at the University of Iowa for 3 years in law school, And they were unhappy enough at this television station blaring out old Rye with a proud voice of Iowa State University. But they were really furious about the fact that Iowa State became a university in my second year of law school. And they said, can't be, because the Constitution says there shall be no other universities other than the one in Iowa City. Well, that was the case originally, but it wasn't the case very long. It was changed.
For those who don't know, WITV was part of a broadcast center on campus that included WI Radio, the public radio station, AM and FM. And it was an ABC affiliate early in the days, in the 1950s, it went on the air. And it broadcast, it had a good signal, had a good tower in Allaman. And so many people watched WITV. Its mission at first was to include educational programming, and I understand they went through virtually all of their filmed archives in no time at all, because television is a huge consumer of material. But in any case, here's this great asset. It wasn't even built with Iowa tax money. It was funded originally by how, Neil?
It was funded significantly by the Manhattan Project.
The money that the university received for work on the Manhattan Project, and that term may be unfamiliar to some younger listeners, but that was the atomic bomb project.
There was a 5% overcharge that went to Iowa State for the compensation, in addition to costs. And the best I could get from the people who are still living and who knew something about it was that that's where probably about 80,000 came from to get it on the air. And then it started making money.
Well, maybe people don't know just how exciting it was to have a television station in the late 40s and early 50s. Television was just expanding, and everybody wanted a TV set, and it seemed everybody wanted to see the programs. And here was WI on the air, and I think it was on the air before the Des Moines station.
Oh, yes, yes. It was about 4 years before the Des Moines stations. They came on in 1954. WITV went on the air in February of 1950, and it was the station. There was no other station this side of Davenport. I think Davenport was just a little ahead of this, but that was the only station in Iowa other than WITV.
So it has a unique history, and that's what made this decision on the part of the state leaders to sell the station so particularly annoying, because this was an asset that didn't cost the taxpayers of Iowa any money. It actually made money, but there was a story told that it was limited as how much money it could make because it didn't want to be too competitive. That might generate resistance from other broadcasters in the state.
There was commentary coming about mid-50s from a gentleman from Fort Dodge who wanted to get a TV station, and he was putting out the word that a public university should not have something that's really designed for the private sector. And that touched it off the point where President Hilton went to Des Moines to visit with the Regents in 1958 about whether we should be selling the station. I ran across that in the records.
Way back in 58. And he apparently persuaded the Regents that this was an asset to the state.
My understanding is, in reading the minutes, that one or two of the regents picked up on this and said, Dr. Hilton, I think we can live with all the problems that you've mentioned. I think this is a big factor for Iowa State University and we should keep it. So that turned him around. And so it was quiet for a while. And then a clothier in Des Moines who was elected to the Iowa Senate picked up the cudgel about 1963 or 64 and began beating the drum. And he was a graduate of the University of Iowa, and behind this whole thing was Pomerantz. And he kept pushing and pushing and pushing various people to come out in opposition to WITV.
Well, once the plan was to sell the station, and you were outraged, really, at what had happened. I remember getting a call from you. I was still on the faculty at the journalism school. And you asked, what's happening, in effect, what's happening in journalism to protect the station or keep the station from being sold? And I was ashamed to tell you that really nothing was going on. I don't know whether my colleagues were just not interested or they were afraid, but there was one colleague who was not noted for being an activist, but he was very well respected in Iowa, and that was Jack Shelley. Yeah. And by golly, he said, this is not right. And Jack Shelley became an active member of the effort to save the station.
Some of the most influential op-ed pieces were penned by Jack Shelley. And I cite them in here. Very lucid, right on target.
Well, I remember when we went to the Board of Regents meeting where the sale decision was going to be voted on. And we presented 5,000 signatures, petitions on signatures. And I remember Pomerantz disdainfully had them virtually thrown in the corner. 5,000 people, that didn't mean anything to him. They had already made up their mind. They had their vote. Jack Shelley and I were sitting in the front row. And they voted to sell the station. And I said kind of quietly, boo, boo. And Jack, sitting next to me, jumped to his feet and said, boo. And the audience rose with him and booed the Board of Regents' decision. It was quite extraordinary. I'd never seen Jack Shelley do that before.
That was pictured somewhere, I remember, because I was sitting, I think, to the left of Jack. And I looked up, and here he was, you know, furious, absolutely furious, livid.
Well, he couldn't understand it because he knew how valuable the station was to the training of the students. It was remarkable that every broadcast journalism student who went through Iowa State had to work at the station for a couple weeks and get some real experience at a professional broadcast station. It was terrific. I just found it a remarkable thing, and it was so good that we actually had students transferring from the University of Missouri's program, and they have a commercial TV station too. Mm-hmm. Transferring to Iowa State to have this opportunity because they felt there they were limited. But here they had unlimited opportunities.
Missouri is still running.
Yes, Missouri still
has
a TV station.
Right beside the highway there that we go down to our lake home.
Well, it's really extraordinary that we couldn't persuade the Regents. And I remember Mr. Pomerantz saying, well, a university doesn't have to have an aircraft factory to teach aeronautical engineering, so why should it have a TV station to teach broadcast journalism? And he missed the whole point. Well, of course, he didn't want to know the point. The whole point was that this was an exceptional, almost unique asset, and this was terrific for the students and for really the people of Iowa. And yet they were determined to sell it. But we put up a pretty good fight. We did a lot of things, that committee.
We did. And when we concluded, after the last chapter was written, which was the D.C. Circuit turned us down on the station license transfer, we had a session that evening. And I think one comment that I made was, look, we lost, but we gave it the very best we had. And it was a battle that had to be fought. We could not simply let that go by.
Well, we persuaded the state legislature, as I recall, to pass a measure opposing the sale. And I think we might have even gotten, and you'll have to remind me, Neil, I may be wrong on this, that even the governor backpedaled a little bit on this.
Just a little bit. But his leash was short. And the leash was held by Pomerantz.
Well,
Pomerantz was his money guy.
Yeah.
And so that almost reversed the roles there. It wasn't Branstad who was calling shots necessarily. It was Pomerantz behind him. But one of the things we discovered early on was there was not one Iowa State University graduate on the Board of Regents. And they had systematically packed it for the last 5 or 6 years. And I wrote an op-ed piece on that. And I was summoned to the governor's office, and he said, and first in the outer office, Doug Gross, who was his chief of staff, said, around here, we didn't take that very kindly, Harl, as if he expected me to withdraw and grovel in the dirt. I said, well, that's just too bad, but it's very sad that you've stacked that group. And they had, because they were planning this for some time. We knew before the closing that the fair market value was closer to $20 million than it was to 12. And they said, when we confronted them, they said, we don't care. We don't care. We want that station gone.
Right. And I remember even something remarkable when they tried to make it look like they were getting more money for the station than they actually were. They included the accounts receivable of $1.5 million. This was money that the station was going to get anyway for advertising that sold, and yet they added that in, so it sounded like they sold it for $13.5 million, which was just total
absolutely
fraud.
That's right. It was. There was a lot of fraud going on. Not just that. There were other things that were fraudulent also. For one thing, when they finally sold it, they sold it to the Iowa State University Broadcast Corporation, and they triggered the gain on it. They triggered the gain so that there wouldn't be very much income tax to pay on the next transfer. And that is something that IRS should have climbed all over them about. And I sent a memo on that because I know a little bit about that area, and they just brushed it off.
Well, as you said, they were so determined to sell that station come hell or high water. What a tragedy. There was no need to do that, and it accomplished nothing good. One comment, one of the proponents of sales said, well, if we don't get it sold, you know, the value of the station will decline. It'll be worthless if the university continues to operate it. And so they sold it to a private group eventually, which moved it to Des Moines. And they've struggled with that station ever since. Their ratings are no higher than they were when the university operated it, in some cases maybe even lower.
Yeah. You may remember the name Lombardo. Well, he was one of them who was pushing against us. And he wanted an evening session. So we had an evening session with him. And he said, tell us what you want us to do. And I said, number one, I want you to get out of this business of trying to buy this TV set and leave it alone.
TV station,
just about like that.
Yeah.
And he said, well, we're going to take better care of you than anyone ever has. We're going to keep it on the campus. We're going to employ students on internships. Within about a month after they closed, they had the skids under the station, and off it went to Des Moines.
That's right.
Absolutely, absolutely lying.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Well, I got myself into trouble, and I had forgotten all about it until I reviewed the book, this wonderful book, Arrogance of Power, that we're discussing, that Neil wrote. And this was something I said to the Iowa State Daily. The new owners immediately fired everybody who'd worked at the station, more than 40 people. And that so outraged me because I knew many of them. I used to go to the station every day with my students. And these were wonderful people who had dedicated their lives to WITV. Well, they're mass firing. And I used a vulgar term, I am ashamed to say, to describe the people who do such a thing. Well, that got in the paper, and I was banned from the TV station. I was not allowed to go into the TV station building. Can you imagine? Faculty member, I was a professor of journalism, and I was not allowed to go into a building on the university campus because these people had were upset that I had said such a thing.
Well, now you're getting into one of the things that interests me about the book, besides the fact that it's a great story.
It's well told.
And it is well told. And also, it's great fun to see all these people that I knew. I was around. I first knew of Neil Harl from the newspaper articles about the attempt to block the sale of WOITV. And I was sitting there cheering and saying, how could they do that? But I was just a bystander. But several people I do know were active. They lost, in a sense, but they fought. And I think that the precedent of fighting is important because the issues, the central issue, the arrogance and power, although you use the other phrase, arrogance of power, which is very appropriate also, is not any less than it was in 1994 when the station was sold. It actually affects not only Iowa State, but virtually every university that I know about in ways that are all slightly different. They don't all have TV stations to protect. But the team player, you weren't a team player, which is a shocking thing to say to a distinguished professor. You're not a team player.
Yeah, you're not following, you're not toeing the line here.
I might point out how that rose. I wrote a lengthy editorial for Friday release on that Friday in which the the sale had been raised in Iowa City. And it was designed to run on Friday morning in the register. And I had the commitment that it was going to run. Well, about Wednesday, I circulated around the campus, and I dropped off a copy at the business office, the finance office, Warren Madden, and he didn't say much. Then I went to the president's office and just dropped it off because he wasn't in. But I got a call from his secretary right away. He doesn't think much of that, and he wants to talk to you. So we set a time, and he called, and the first thing he said was, "You're not much of a team player, are you?" And I said, "I'm a team player when it's in the best interests of the university, and it's a university issue. I am not a team player when it comes to something that is demonstrably damaging to the university." And we went on there for a while. Finally, I was getting a little bit impatient, and I said, "You know, presidents come and presidents go. Universities go on forever." And he clunk. He hung up the phone. He said, "We're not getting anywhere." And I didn't talk to him for 18 months. But then the interesting thing was I received the Regents Faculty Excellence Award given at Cedar Falls by the Board of Regents. And he was supposed to – Pomerantz was going to be there and give the awards. But Pomerantz came stomping in at the last minute, went down at the end of the hall and sat in the corner by himself. And so the university representatives made the presentations there. But there was another presentation back on the campus two or three days later. And here was the president, Jiske, handing out these awards. And here I came along. I was watching his face, and he had a little bit of – just a little bit of a faint smile. And I shook his hand. That was the only time we had visited and didn't visit anymore. He was he was caught in the middle. But he was hired specifically to go after that station. And if you've read through that passage, the deans, with one exception, were all opposed. And they used every trick in the book to try to get those deans to change, but they didn't.
Well, they certainly pressured them to toe the line as well. And we know from a previous experience at journalism what happens when you fight for something you want and you're told under no circumstances to stop. And that had to do with the elimination of three small degrees that we gave in journalism, agricultural journalism, home economics journalism, and I think engineering journalism. And there was a period where there had to be a report to the regents that programs were being cut to make the universities more efficient. And those three majors that cost nothing to operate were eliminated over the protest of deans of the colleges affected. Right. And they were told, shut up, right, as I understand it.
Well, that committee that I was telling you about, the long-range strategic planning committee that was appointed in about 1988, about mm-hmm. when it was. It was just after Eaton had arrived. Mm-hmm. And the message was to us, your job is to be sure that we are narrowing this place down. Well, one thing they discovered was when you start reducing numbers of students, you run into huge financial problems because you can add students when you're going up. And the fixed costs become less and less per capita. But in this case, they learned that when you start reducing, and which is what they wanted to do, you really pay a huge price because the fixed costs are still there. Your overhead is still there. So that was the only casualty was agricultural journalism. A bunch of us dug in our heels and said, we are not going along with this. And we've got a committee appointed. And the committee agreed with us, and they finally gave up on it. But they did get ag journalism.
Well, I want to come back to the book. Neil, I remember you saying that you wrote much of that while you were in flying places on the airplane, and you were writing furiously to get this down before the memory fades at all. It's quite a remarkable story, and it's a good example of what can happen to an institution when political forces array against it, and they decide for whatever reason to go after the university. And frankly, it's not over today.
No. We have been seeing the gradual politicization of the regions in this state. We prided ourselves for years and years under leadership of, among others, the furniture store owner in Boone,
Whitaker?
Yes. And he was, I thought, a model. And we would talk about this. But that has changed. That has changed. And the biggest need we have in this state is to reverse that. It is entirely too political.
Well, coming back to the story of WI, I worked at WI, although I was on the faculty of ISU journalism. I spent a lot of time at WI because this was a terrific opportunity for students to get practical experience. And so for quite a few years, the morning news at WI was staffed by students. Initially, students even anchored the news, and later they had one of their regular staff members do that. But what a great experience it was for them. They had to get up very early. I, for one, had to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to get there in time. And I remember walking to WI through the snow, uphill both ways, of course. No, actually, seriously, though, it was such a great experience. It was worth the sacrifice that I and some other faculty members made. So now we come to the 1990s and this force now that has been bubbling for many years. Why is ISU operating a private business, and how can, you know, this is not good and we should get rid of it at all costs. And so unfortunately this station was sold. And we, this group, this nonpartisan group that you chaired and you organized really, Neil, did a remarkable job of explaining to the people why this was not a good idea, but we just could not prevail over the power and the arrogance that was there.
But, you know, we prevailed in the district court with Judge Scheckman, and we were very happy at that stage.
That was quite an experience, incidentally. There is a magnificent courthouse in Boone where we went as a group to testify. It's something right out of a movie, this big, glorious courtroom, very ornate and elaborate. And we testified, and he ruled that the station, in effect, should remain at ISU. But, of course, his decision was blithely ignored, as were almost any decision that went against
us. Well, it was appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed us in November of 1993. Which is another story in itself. The author of that opinion was a year ahead of me in law school, and I know him fairly well. But I cannot understand how any court could have reached the decision they did. And it essentially did a lot of damage to one segment of Iowa law relative to public agencies. So it was the point where I really was beginning to wonder. So we went to the Court of Appeals then in Washington. That was a last-ditch stand, and the book talks about that and the snide way that the other side was telling us you've lost already, and we hadn't even had the hearing. But we learned a lot, and we learned that power is awfully important.
Well, Neil, you may remember, well, you know, of course, that we had to raise this money from people. We had no secret pool of funds. We had to ask people, and we raised quite a bit of money from individual Iowans who thought this was something worth preserving at Iowa State. And I want to credit them for supporting our effort on their behalf,
yeah,
really.
Oh, yes. We raised about $140,000.
And that's, when you think about it, that's quite a deal. I remember we had one day, we went to a local business who let us use their telephones. That was before cell phones were widely owned. And we called all over the place and got very good response. I don't think we got anybody who said, no, I'm opposed to that. They gave what they could. It might have been small amounts, but we got money donated that way.
Right.
Well, I co-edited a little newspaper that we published to report what we were doing, and I had a lot of fun doing that, although I must say that it was frustrating to report the crazy things that were happening to accelerate the sale. And it just is really something. So I think we tried to record in this publication, it was really a pretty low-budget operation, what was happening. But this book, Arrogance and Power, is a terrific summary and history of what happened. And it's not, it really goes beyond the sale of a TV station owned by a university. It talks about the whole mechanism that we see now on a much grander scale. And it shows how important it is for the average citizen to be alert and to organize, because I think at some point when the cause is great enough, people can stop it, even when they're facing tremendous arrogance and power.
Yeah. This is KHOI Community Radio, and Heart of Iowa has been hosting a discussion between distinguished professor Neil Harl and Professor Emeritus Tom Beal, Harl's former colleague in the struggle to prevent the forced sale of WOI-TV. The remainder of the program will consist of selections from the book Arrogance and Power, The Saga of WOI-TV by Neil E. Harl, as read by Susan Franzen. Chapter 1. The Dawn of Telecommunications at Iowa State College. This is a story that should never have had to be told. This is a story of a 15-year crusade by a powerful political figure, Marvin Pomerantz, backed by a compliant governor, Terry Branstad, to wrest ownership of a television station, WOI-TV, from the hands of Iowa State University. This is a story of political arrogance. It is also a story of rising anger from those affected adversely by the sale, anger from students, faculty, alumni, and others, anger that may diminish with time but will never go away. It is a story of how one of America's finest universities was diminished by petulance apparently stemming in part from institutional jealousy and an out-of-control governing board. It is a sordid story of arrogance and power that combined to transcend economic reason and educational justification for the station. It is a story that had to be told so that the lesson so painfully learned should never again have to be experienced. It is a lesson of how decisions affecting the public interest should not be made. It is a story of how Iowa State University, using funds from various sources, including some left over from the Manhattan Project of World War II fame, went on the air February 21, 1950. It is a story of how that television station gave Iowa State University a significant lead in broadcast journalism, meteorology education, video production, and educational television, and ultimately a lead in educating by satellite around the world. It is a story of how arrogance and power combined to overwhelm the voices of reason raised in dissent. It is a story of how decisions should not be made affecting a university. It is this feature that makes this story widely relevant in the United States and indeed around the world. The early history of WOI-TV. The interest of Iowa State College in television began long before most persons realize. Before World War II, but as with television nationally, was delayed by the war. The first indication that Iowa State College was interested in moving into television, based upon materials in the Iowa State University archives, is a letter dated January 28, 1941. The letter from President Charles E. Frehley to Dean T.R. Agg, Dean of the Division of Engineering, W.I. Griffith, manager of WOI Radio, and M.S. Coover, Department of Electrical Engineering, reads as follows. I should appreciate it if you will work out plans leading to an application for an experimental wavelength for television research at Iowa State College. I believe the time has come when we should get into this in a serious way. In addition to that first document from the ISU archives, there are many others. Between the time that President Charles Frehley urged Iowa State College to begin exploration into television broadcasting in 1946 to the sale of the station in 1994, there were many ups and downs recorded in the Iowa State University archives. The documents from the golden years of 1950 to 55 show the excitement of the dawning of the television age, when WOI-TV was truly an experimental station and was, for the first 2 years after it began broadcasting, the only television station in the Des Moines area. As long as Briley was president of the college, WOI-TV was a top priority for educational broadcasting. Succeeding presidents varied in their support, although it should be mentioned that President Robert Parks was a very strong supporter of the station as Iowa State College became Iowa State University. It was not until Martin Jitzke, who Harl considers to be one of the villains of the story, as you heard earlier, that the university president no longer supported WOI-TV. Now, we are going to go to Neil Harl's own words as he gives us the conclusion of what he considers to be the message of this story. Chapter 16, Perspective on the Campaign to Sell the Station and the Resistance. The sale of WOI will surely go down in history as one of the blackest hours for Iowa State University and one of the darkest times for the state of Iowa. It was a totally irrational act, driven by jealousy and fueled by greed, engineered by an out-of-control governing board. One can learn, however, even from irrational and despicable acts. This chapter concludes the story of WOI-TV as a vital contributor to Iowa State University educational programs, with a perspective on the battle to prevent the sale of the station and the lessons learned along the way. The need for vigilance. In retrospect, the greatest regret in resisting the sale was that the resistance should have commenced much sooner. The price of vigilance is high, but the price of not being vigilant is incalculably greater. The danger signals were flying long before the resistance emerged in early 1992. The push by Marvin Pomerantz to get Governor Robert Ray's Economy Committee to include the sale of the station in its report was not widely publicized at the time, but the campaign by Governor Terry Branstad to sell WOI-TV in 1985 should have rung alarm bells all over the state and for alumni everywhere. Perhaps the fact that the sale of WOI-TV had been an agenda item for a small group of dedicated critics for nearly two decades before that accounts for some of the inaction. Besides, the mid-1980s was one of the most traumatic times in the economy of this state. In the year, Branstad and his minions were working aggressively behind the scenes to get others to sell the station and take the heat. Farmland values dropped 32%. Bank closures were an almost weekly happening. Foreclosure sales were widespread and farm bankruptcies were soaring. And here was Branstad relying heavily on Iowa State University to assist him in dealing with the farm debt crisis on the one hand, trying to wrest from the campus one of its most valuable features of Iowa State University on the other. Nearly a decade later, it seems unbelievable that a responsible chief executive of the state who turned to Iowa State University that year for assistance in dealing with the most serious economic woes the state had faced since the Great Depression, was at the same time engaged in a campaign of stealth to force the sale of the station. Lessons learned. The most important aspect of this book in terms of benefit to posterity is the lessons learned from the long battle to resist the sale of the station. Each observer of the scene undoubtedly has his or her own short list. Here are 12 candidates for the list. 1. An important lesson learned in this battle was the great cost of ignoring warning signs that were clearly unmistakable and ominous for nearly a decade. The Board of Regents did not sneak up on WOI-TV by dead of night and overpower the keepers of the gate at dawn. Individuals stalked the station for more than a dozen years, like a carefully calculated effort to encircle and methodically decimate the enemy. 2. The selection of a chief administrative officer of a major university is a huge and daunting task. One looks for intellectual leadership, a distinguished record of scholarly activity, an ability to encourage the highest possible level of performance by faculty, staff, and students, and unquestioned personal integrity. To this short list must be added another, courage, willingness, and an ability to be effective administratively and yet be a voice of independence from the governing board. Sadly, that was not present here. Although the Iowa Supreme Court unbelievably excused Martin Jitsky for not stopping the sale of the station by assuming that the Board of Regents would have fired him if he had done so. The truth probably is that if Jitsky had refused to approve the sale, he would have backed Marvin Pomerantz and his board into a corner from which they could not safely have escaped without acceding to his position. Had they fired Jitsky, he would have become a hero in academic circles, and the Regents would have been burned to a crisp in the ensuing firestorm. Perhaps searches at Iowa State University in the future will give some weight to this important criterion for employment as the chief administrative officer of the university. 3. Universities, as places for objective scholarly inquiry, need and deserve a measure of insulation from the real world and a measure of autonomy in matters of decision-making affecting the academic side of the institution. Moreover, the faculty, staff, and students deserve to be heard with respect to all matters relating to the academy. Universities should develop and nurture a culture that permits dissent and indeed encourages dissent. The resilience of an institution in tolerating the type of resistance developed in this case is a measure of the commitment of the institution to the pursuit of truth. Certainly, a culture of expecting everyone to be a team player on the team of central administration or of anyone else is antithetical to the notion of free and open inquiry. 4. The importance of an educated and informed citizenry ever poised to intervene in matters of importance to the human family should never be underestimated in a free and open society. As the organization entrusted with the task of marshaling the energies of alumni in the interests of higher education generally, and the institution in particular, alumni associations should be viewed as more than social and recreational facilitators for the membership. A college or university alumni association should never be or become captive of the university administration or the governing board. A cordial working relationship is appropriate and indeed laudable, but it must be at an arm's length. Throughout the WOITV fight, with the exception of the Iowa State University publication Visions, the alumni organization was paralyzed by fear and concern of offending the university administration or the Board of Regents. It went well beyond what will they think or what might they do. It was more like, we simply cannot do that. So lists of names and addresses of alumni were denied, even though the lists were in the hands of Iowa State University and thus arguably subject to the open records law. The leadership of the Iowa State University Alumni Association demonstrated a decided reluctance to speak out. The organization that should have been in the forefront of efforts to save WOITV from the ignominy of the auction block was instead bringing up the rear, asking no questions, offering no opinions, demonstrating the ultimate in Martin Jitsky's concept of a team player. Steps should be taken when no issue is pending before the group or the university that could distract the organization from an honest assessment of the relationship of the ISU Alumni Association to Iowa State University, to frame a set of policies and guidelines robust and sturdy enough to introduce a modicum of independence into the relationship of the Iowa State University Alumni Association to the Iowa State University administration. 5. The case has presented fascinating contrasts of the impact of university presidents on Iowa State University and its mission. Presidents can and do place their stamp on the institution, for good or ill. President Friley provided strong, decisive leadership from the beginning in establishment of a television broadcasting station. His vision apparently was not shared, at least not as enthusiastically, by President Hilton. President Parks devoted his 21 years to fighting off the vultures. President Eaton tried accommodation and left before the critical decisions had to be made. President Jitsky, the loyal foot soldier that he is, carries out orders and then maybe raises questions. Without much doubt, the Jitsky presidency will be known in history as the time when the university bowed to the pressure of a misguided governing board, succumbed to the threats of the head of that board, and dismantled a significant part of the university's educational capability. 6. A lesson learned painfully in this process was that when people stand by and allow a governor to pack and politicize an important agency of government, the consequences may be untidy, unseemly, and unacceptable long term. It is far more difficult to rectify a politicization than to keep it from occurring. The people and institutions that are whipsawed in the process often suffer painful consequences that may not be reversible once the people rise up and assert their supremacy. In this instance, Governor Terry Branstad was virtually unchallenged in his stealthy plan to eliminate from the Board of Regents all individuals with ties to Iowa State University, to increase the number of University of Iowa graduates on the board to a majority, 5, to appoint one of his closest advisors to the board, and then to twist the arms of the sitting regents to get Marvin Pomerantz elected president of the board. Such political dominance of the Board of Regents should never have been allowed to happen by the State Senate, by the Iowa State University Alumni Association, and by the people of Iowa. 7. The risk of politicization of supposedly independent administrative agencies of government is greater the longer a governor is in office. While there are credible arguments against term limits, there are also powerful arguments in their favor. In a democratic society, no one should gain a position of power reminiscent of a monarchy. By appointing all members of commissions and boards, many of the appellate court judges and a large proportion of the trial court judges, a governor is placed in a position of power and influence not usually seen in a democracy. 8. One of the important lessons learned in this saga has been that individuals acting collectively can wield an immense amount of power. Once organized, a highly motivated group assembled behind a worthy cause can overcome enormous political barriers. The group Iowans for WOI-TV marshaled their forces, generated funds, pooled their individual skills and abilities, and engaged in a pitched battle for nearly 3 years. Whether the group made a difference will be argued for some time. The experiences of Iowans for WOI-TV suggest that there is a need in each community for permanent as well as ad hoc groups to monitor the performance of public agencies. 9. The steering committee for Iowans for WOI-TV, at one of its earlier meetings, made a commitment to take the high road, which called for dealing with issues and not personalities, even in those instances in which personal behavior was relevant to the issues at hand. By adhering steadfastly to that commitment, the group maintained a high level of support and respect throughout the battle. Following any other route would undoubtedly have been counterproductive in terms of effectiveness of the group. However, the strategy pursued allowed several culprits to escape the criticism they deserved and denied the public information that the public deserved to know. 11. The basic institutions of society, including the judicial system and the legislature, should be important allies in combating the abuses of the executive branch of government. The executive branch is perhaps the most activist part of the government, developing and implementing initiatives, mustering support for solving problems, and carrying out the agenda of the chief executive. But it is a branch of government that is heavily dependent upon the whims, the objectives, the insights, and the frailties of that individual. When that branch of government takes on a renegade character, the other two branches of government become important components of the process of rebalancing the government. In this instance, the Iowa State Senate displayed the kind of independence one should expect of the legislative branch of government. Regrettably, the Republicans in the Iowa House of Representatives rolled over under the pressure from the governor's office on the critical vote to block the sale and deserve no plaudits from this quarter. 12. Finally, a lesson also learned in the episode is that there are downsides to any attempt to challenge established authority. Fortunately, however, the downside consequences were relatively minor. One member of the resistance, Tom Beal, professor of journalism and mass communication, was denied access to the WOI-TV studios after the sale. His offense? Calling the buyers a common slang term for illegitimate offspring. A few members of the Iowa State University faculty were quietly advised to watch their step. More importantly, many individuals chose not to play a visible role in the resistance because of fears of recrimination. Every institution, educational and otherwise, should endeavor to enable those with legitimate grievances to pursue them and to seek redress without fear of recrimination. An institution is strengthened, not weakened, in robust debate, even on the most sensitive of topics. Those who would stifle the right of free expression would thereby create a narrow and uniform foundation for the growth and development of the human family. Epilogue. It's been 7 years since the hotly contested sale of WOI-TV. That should be an adequate period to assess the promises made by those pushing the sale. The message is clear and brutal. The only remaining tangible evidence that WOI-TV graced the Iowa State University campus for more than 44 years is the uplink equipment which is still owned by Iowa State. But the equipment is useless. The personnel, broadcasting equipment, and editing facilities have long since been moved to Des Moines, and the cost to access the uplink is prohibitive. Indeed, the shift to Des Moines had commenced a few months after the sale was completed, despite repeated assurances that the station would remain in Ames. Less than 3 months after the buyers obtained possession of the station's asset, the station manager announced they were seeking space in Des Moines for station operations. By late 1994, much of the station's operations were being carried out in Des Moines. With the station moved to Des Moines, the university proceeded to remodel for other uses the building bought and paid for by WOI-TV revenues. It remains for another book, on another day, for someone to explain the depth of animus that could lead to such carnage. Clearly, a powerful set of forces was unleashed on a vulnerable institution. Unfortunately, the bargain basement sale of WOI-TV was not the extent of losses from those who have labored diligently to diminish Iowa State University and sharply narrow its focus. In the years since loss of the television station, Iowa State University has also lost, one, the university flight service, which provided as many as 7 airplanes for extension education and off-campus credit courses. The only airplane remaining is one used almost exclusively by the university president and the Board of Regents. 2. Fire service training, which had for decades provided extension education for firefighting personnel throughout Iowa. And 3. The highly respected, world-renowned, and profitable Iowa State University Press. Heart of Iowa Today featured Neil Harrell's book, Arrogance and Power, The Saga of WOI-TV. First, with a discussion between Neil Harrell and Tom Beal about their reflections of the events described in the book. The last half of the program consisted of selections from the book as read by Susan Franzen.